This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Thank you all for being here. I really, really appreciate you coming out on Sunday morning to talk about fascism. Everyone's dream start to a beautiful day. I want to thank Haymarket and all the sponsoring organizations for putting on this great weekend. All the other panelists and speakers, it's been a privilege to listen and learn from everyone. So I'm going to speak a little bit about, well, actually I'm not going to speak about the book. I'm going to continue thinking with all of you about the things that I thought about in this book as they continue to change. Earlier this summer, someone asked me if I am for or against immigration. Mind you, this was at a wedding here in Chicago between the son of an Irish American and a Mexican immigrant and the daughter of Vietnamese immigrants. Still, it was a more difficult question to answer than it might seem. I am, as no doubt all of us here are, for a world in which every person's needs are met and in which they and their kin are able to thrive wherever they choose to live, either in their place of birth or on the other side of the planet. But that is not our world, at least not yet. In our world, more narrowly, in this country, to say that one is for immigration is, on one level, to signal one's affinity for a certain set of discourses about diversity, melting pots, the tired, poor, huddled masses yearning to breathe free, and all the rest of it. These ideas are near and dear to the hearts of well-meaning liberals and progressives, and constitute a significant part of the common sense of many more Americans besides. But these ideas also obscure the material realities of migration, the living and working conditions of migrants, and critically, the divergent regimes of policing, surveillance, and regulation to which migrants are subject by a state that categorizes them as documented or undocumented, refugees or asylum seekers, in other words, deserving or undeserving. For the past three decades or so, the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border and the increasingly fascistic internal enforcement apparatus have contributed to the production of a permanent, settled, undocumented labor force. Millions of people, many of whom likely otherwise would have engaged in circular migration, now locked in place as a hyper-exploitable, precisely because they are deportable, fraction of the domestic working class. If we got rid of CBP and ICE tomorrow, however, the crisis conditions that such migrants live every day would not be resolved. Citizenship and the rights that come with it, however attenuated, would remain locked behind another, in some respects, even more daunting, border of bureaucracy. In what has become yet another of her famous formulations, doubtless invoked a dozen times already this weekend, Ruth Wilson Gilmore reminds us that abolition is about presence, not absence. Just as prison abolition does not simply mean the knocking down of walls and the universal release of the incarcerated, although it does mean that, and police abolition does not simply mean the removal of police from our streets and our lives, although it does mean that. Border abolition does not simply mean the disappearance of border patrols, surveillance drones, ICE raids, and detention centers, although it does mean that. What then must be present to abolish the border? What must be present for someone to make a home in an unfamiliar place? It is common sense that the state is needed to provide care, housing, and support for refugees, asylees, and other migrant populations. But what happens when that responsibility is left solely to the state and not just the state in the abstract, but the late neoliberal crisis state, the anti-state state. Let's get even more specific. In the past year or so, some 100,000 asylum seekers have either made their own way to New York City or been bused there, that is, trafficked, by border states. These are people who must be cared for, even if Mayor Eric Adams has sought to challenge the right to shelter available to anyone in the city. Tabloids like The Post are careful to note how much it is costing taxpayers to house and feed asylum seekers, without, of course, investigating what conditions are in the mayor's new, ostensibly temporary respite centers. Exempt from even the meager regulations that apply to the city's shelter system, many of these centers are run by private contractors. One is located in a shuttered state prison in Harlem, another in a warehouse at the JFK Airport, formerly used as a USPS overflow facility, a third in the old police academy in Manhattan. Activists, elected politicians, and members of the media have only been allowed limited access. Rumors and reports of violence and abuse from security staff inside abound, seeming to acknowledge that people cannot live in rooms packed with cots mere feet apart, three showers for 300 people. The mayor's press secretary described the centers as waiting rooms. Confronted with evidence that some asylum seekers have been forced to remain in shelters for days on end, he said, "It's a waiting room for as long as it takes." Responding to pressure from both Mayor Adams and elected officials representing the smaller upstate cities now also being asked to house migrants, Governor Kathy Hochul demanded greater aid from President Biden and the federal government. And fair enough, the federal government should intervene more assertively. There is, of course, a twist. In a public address, Hochul said, quote, "For me, the answer to these two crises, a humanitarian crisis and our workforce crisis, is so crystal clear and common sense. Let them get the work authorizations. Let them work. Legally, let them work." According to Adams, if federal funds are not increased and migrants not authorized to work, the city is going to be, quote unquote, decimated. The origin of the threat, though, is muddled. Adams speaks in terms of forces beyond human control. Quote, "When the storm hit upstate, they called New York City. New York City has always been here for the entire state," he said, speaking of the flooding in the Hudson Valley earlier this summer, before going on. Quote, "The storm of migrant asylum seekers have hit us for over a year now. We need help." But Adams has also made it clear that his administration will start kicking asylum seekers out of respite centers, leaving them on the street. Indeed, even as Adams urges the federal government to move to integrate migrants into the formal workforce, the NYPD is raiding these shelters, confiscating, that is, stealing, the mopeds that they use either to get to work or in the course of their work. So it is that the crises are converging. Hundreds of thousands of displaced and dispossessed migrants provide the solution for the crisis of an aging labor force in a post-industrial economy driven increasingly by service and care work. That migrant workers, whether made to move by war, climate change, economic conditions, or some combination of the three, are already in a state of extreme vulnerability and precarity, living and working under the gaze of both the state and the boss, means that they are even more readily exploited than citizen workers. Despite the valiant efforts of groups like the Black and Arab Migrant Solidarity Alliance or NYC Ice Watch, tens of thousands of new New Yorkers cannot be cared for through mutual aid networks and activist efforts alone, nor should they have to be. But we cannot abandon that responsibility to the state either. Without the social infrastructure of inclusion that makes the city into a home for all who live there, regardless of how or when they arrived, the machinery of exclusion will grow in its place. In recent weeks, aggressive protests have targeted migrant shelters. In Sunset Park, migrants from one part of the world demand the exclusion of those from another. On Staten Island, mobs of homeowners, descendants of yet another much earlier wave of immigration, scream, "Go back where you came from," at buses full of asylum seekers. The journalist Molly Osberg described the scene. Some residents sat on lawn chairs drinking from solo cups next to a two-story banner that read, "No effing way." On one lawn, a woman who lived on the block and declined to give her name lamented that migrants received free health care. "The media wants to say we don't want them here, that we want them in other places," she said. "That's not true. We don't want them anywhere." A man next to her pulled up a photograph of his Sicilian grandfather on his phone to illustrate what it looks like when an immigrant comes to America, quote unquote, the right way. Across the street, a 68-year-old woman named Debbie held a cardboard sign reading, "Hey Adams, the crackers are here." A self-described libertarian, she said she was concerned about crime and disease from the people staying in the school. "Why not put them on Rikers?" she asked. "It's a contained space where you can vet them and give them all kinds of medical tests." Around 300 migrants were supposed to be housed in the Staten Island Respite Center, a former school. Only 20 were there at the time of the last official count, and fewer every day as the demonstrations continue. Direct action, as they say, gets the goods. One mother at a recent anti-migrant protest on Staten Island told a local broadcaster, quote, "We love people. We just want to protect our children." Protect them from what? It is simultaneously unclear and abundantly clear, both totally vague and incredibly specific. She was invoking years of propaganda targeting trans people, drag queens, critical race theory, woke mobs, cancel culture, you know the list. Every new front that opens in the so-called culture wars, disorienting as it may be, is a new venue in the production of a reactionary politics that proclaims itself as returning to tradition, but is really a process of creating something new. The fascist threat mobilized by and around the promised return to a mythic, romantic past does not consist in the realization of that return. After all, even if it were possible to turn back the clock, that imagined past never really happened to begin with. But even failed attempts at recreation might conjure something new. The attempt to recreate the old ends up creating something hypermodern. Why do so many of these moral panics revolve around children and imagined threats to their well-being? It is worth remembering one of the most enduring white supremacist slogans, the infamous 14 words. Quote, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children," end quote. This is just making the implicit explicit. Why are so many of the demonized figures adults who are in some way responsible for children? On one level, what motivates this is straightforward bigotry, racism, homophobia, transphobia, misogyny. On another level, though, it seems to me that taken all together, we can see this as a multi-pronged assault on the practices of social reproduction. Seen from this perspective, who are the targets? Librarians, teachers, educators of all stripes, as well as their unions and even the institutions themselves. This is happening across the country at various scales. Humanities and social science departments are being disintegrated, consolidated, or outright disbanded, even as shiny new STEM buildings spring up out of the ground. How long even these will contain students remains to be seen. Any lab tech or web developer who thinks his work isn't subject to the same pressures of automation and intensification is in for an ugly surprise. Even as we set aside fear-mongering and myth-making about so-called artificial intelligence, automation, and large language models, we can recognize the implications that a significant leap forward in technological development has for various kinds of labor, which is to say they are the same implications that they always are, to the extent that living labor is replaced with dead labor. Fixed capital, machinery, technology, whatever you want to call it, that living labor is rendered surplus. Some of those workers will find jobs in industries and sectors that still require human hands. The rest must fend for themselves. They are now surplus. Surplus to what? To the requirements of capital. Except capital also requires this surplus. The surplus is, of course, the infamous reserve army of labor upon which capital can draw as needed. A mass of unwaged or underpaid workers desperate to put food on the table, who might be used to break strikes, for example, or be put to work in new, extensive regimes of accumulation as the need for living labor increases again, or simply as an ambient threat against the formally employed, waged working class, who can be induced to accept conditions they might not otherwise for fear of slipping into the abyss. The more brutally the lumpen proletariat are treated, publicly and privately, by cops and guards and judges, the more reason for the proletariat to stay in line. Our conjuncture is marked by dramatic shifts in the capitalist state's management of this surplus population. Globalization, deindustrialization, the neoliberal turn. These were not only accompanied, but made possible in many places by the warehousing of surplus racialized labor. In the 1970s and 1980s, big capital and its allies, the cops, the landlords, the real estate developers, the financiers, clawed back the political territory gained by movements of workers and the oppressed in the decades preceding. The revolutionary tide was stemmed and something new took its place, the law and order society. Social problems were not resolved but disappeared into the abyss of jails and prisons, as were the revolutionaries who sought to do something about them. This strategy, sorry to say, has been quite effective. Too many on the outside remain convinced that these problems are someone else's. As ever, the goal is pacification, not progress. If it was the crisis of Keynesianism and New Deal Great Society liberalism that created the conditions for neoliberalism's rise under Ford and Carter, its consolidation under Reagan, And having passed through the high neoliberalism of the Clinton, Bush, and Obama years, we now find ourselves confronting what might be dubbed the crisis of late neoliberalism. How deep does this crisis run? Looking to the political sphere, we find nothing short of a clown show. At the national level, the GOP is in disarray, riven by infighting. Its flagship propaganda network, Fox News, flailing in the aftermath of several devastating lawsuits, and its presidential candidate, Trump, under indictment, however many times over now, with no challenger capable of credibly breaking his hold on the base. At the state level and the level of the judiciary, of course, it remains as powerful as ever, possibly even more so. Democrats, meanwhile, are unpopular, but somehow managing to hold it all together, maybe even shifting the national common sense with legislative packages like the CHIPS Act and the IRA about what kinds of economic interventions are necessary and permissible, legislation shaped in part by bipartisan anxiety and aggression about China. Pundits and commentators can't seem to make up their minds as to whether the Biden economy is good or not. Basically, people are still struggling to pay their bills, but it could be a lot worse. Meanwhile, the climate crisis looms as large as ever. Fossil fuel capital, which created that crisis, stands to gain the most from its resolution. And all the while, people keep arriving at and crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, seeking refuge, asylum, and work. At the beginning of the Biden administration, Vice President Kamala Harris warned migrants, "If you come to our border, you will be turned back." Somehow, this has proven unpersuasive. Borders do not stop people from moving, but they are a determinate factor in producing the circumstances of that movement, how people get where they're going, and what their life might be like when they arrive. Borders are Janus-like, facing both inward and outward, backwards in history and forward into the future, like prisons produced in crisis, used to resolve crisis, and productive of the crises to come. A key component in the machinery of exclusion, which appears designed to keep people out, borders are really about what some in feminist and migrant studies refer to as differential inclusion, that is, determining the conditions of their arrival, their existence, and their labor. In the era of globalization, we often hear about capital's mobility as against labor's fixity. But this is not the whole story, only a part of it. Capital has ever been in motion. Indeed, capital is value in motion, motion through space and time, but also through forms. It is in this process of transformation that value is created, or more precisely, extracted from the living labor of the workers who make the transformation possible. So capital moves, yes, but it has always moved. It congeals and evaporates, contracts and explodes, having taken the shape of a building or a bridge or a commodity on a container ship from Shenzhen to Long Beach. It aches to be transformed again, valorization and devaluation pulling each other forward, lurching through history. Labor is like this too, both fixed in place and free to move, as dictated by the needs of capital. Workers are themselves always on the move, free, except when they are not. Borders, jails, prisons, schools, hospice centers, hospitals, psych wards, rehabs, halfway houses, refugee camps, detention centers, all manner of spaces regulating and managing the movement of the working class. Passage through, between, and within these spaces produces differentiation, produces subjects, produces consciousness. What marks our conjuncture further is not necessarily the contradiction between capital's relative mobility and labor's relative fixity, both of which disguise the materiality of fixed capital and mobile labor, but the proliferation of kinds of spaces between which capital and labor alike might move, and the kinds of borders, barriers, and boundaries through and over which they might pass. The freedom of the migrant, quote unquote, of the migrant worker thus underscores the long historical contradiction of free labor. Ostensibly free to pick up and move through and across borders in search of work, and thereby subject to ever greater regimes of surveillance and control, regardless of legal status. Whatever theoretical support left critics of border abolition might think to find in Marx's theory of the reserve army of labor is here undercut. The argument, basically, is that the presence of migrants in a national labor market suppresses wages. This was the standard position of organized labor in various left parties for many decades, and it gives far too much credit to capitalists, assuming that in a tighter labor market, they would simply start paying more. Indeed, this takes bourgeois economic theories of supply and demand at face value. In fact, what makes wages go up is workers demanding higher wages and having the power to make it so. What makes wages go down is capital's ability to immobilize the workers' movement. That immobilization is managed through the infrastructure of race and racism, which is itself changing over time, responsive to the wider historical situation as it unfolds. Questions of who counts, who has history, and who is cast aside, who is waste, who is surplus, are back on the table. A very narrow notion of inclusion has exploded across scales. The home as private property, an asset constantly threatened by devaluation, here articulated as a threat from the dispossessed racialized other, against which value must be protected through the fortressification at the level of the family, the neighborhood, the community, the city, the nation, which is also the home. Is this not just the raw material of racial capitalism? And if so, what makes it fascistic? Crisis, the inability of the system to reproduce itself as it has done. Literal, actual, historical Oliver North recently declared American universities to be hotbeds of Marxism, describing them as socialist re-education camps. And we know what Oliver North thinks ought to be done in such cases to the people branded as such. Because what does this really signify? Not simply a threat to capital, because I think we can all admit that as many exciting, dynamic, and even revolutionary efforts as there are developing this moment, we are still far from the war of maneuver. We're barely in the war of position. So why do they bother? Because it's not accumulation as such that is threatened, but a crisis of the internal contradictions of capital that needs resolving, a crisis of overaccumulation that requires release, that requires further disinvestment from the few remaining public institutions that work for working people, and in fact not simply disinvestment, but frontal assault on the gains made in struggle for ethnic studies, queer studies, women's studies, trans studies, and black studies. Fear-mongering about and reaction against critical race theory, or a professor who voices support for Palestine, or one who stands up for her students' bodily autonomy and reproductive justice, is not simply about those things, but it's not pure sublimation either. The Zionist lobby really does want anyone who isn't on board to shut up or get fired. But this also exists in an even broader political project to recompose ruling blocs at the scale of the city, region, nation, hemisphere, planet. And what is the response to this? Here we come to the problem of anti-fascism in crisis. That is to say, the problem of how to be anti-fascist in a time of crisis, and how to be anti-fascist when anti-fascism is itself in crisis. As for the latter, we face a double-edged problematic in the mainstreaming of both fascism and anti-fascism. Biden Democrats have explicitly sought to position themselves as leading a popular front, co-opting radical critiques of fascism that implicate liberals and centrists in its rise both in the United States and abroad. Meanwhile, the GOP has absorbed Trumpist fascism so thoroughly that a Ron DeSantis son and rad meme army looks silly and pointless. What are they trying to outflank? If I take anything away from the cycles of anti-fascist protest and struggle that began roughly in 2015, it's that even as the electoral sphere remains an important one in the making and remaking of fascist politics, we cannot allow the rhythm of our analysis or our practice to be dictated by the tempo of elections if we are serious about articulating an anti-fascist politics that is not simply going to get swamped by a liberalism frantically grasping for legitimacy. If the ultimate goal of the anti-fascist struggle is not to defeat fascism as such, but to make a world in which fascism cannot exist to begin with, then we must begin working our way towards something like an everyday anti-fascism. There are times when public space must be defended, Proud Boys and neo-Nazis confronted, fascists chased out of town, but I'm not sure that such spectacles make for a durable, reproducible mass movement that can push beyond defense. Still, there is something unsatisfying to me about simply declaring the necessity of this. It's both obvious and nonspecific, verging on alarmist. Fascism is everywhere all the time. This is no way to live, but for the fact that its constituent parts are everywhere all the time and do require constant vigilance. If you will permit me, I'm going to close with a brief personal anecdote. Last summer, I was working in a pizza restaurant in Brooklyn and organizing a union with my coworkers. It had been rumored that the owner's adult children were being paid an allowance through payroll, but we never knew for sure. What we did confirm was that the owner was paying to support his adult children's filmmaking careers, luminaries of the self-described reactionary downtown Manhattan art scene known as Dimes Square. When it became public that the boss was a producer on the kid's most recent bit of fascistic transphobic propaganda, we put our heads together. What were we going to do? We hadn't won a union yet. The organizing drive wasn't even above ground. At that point, we'd really only had a few organizing committee meetings. So we kept pushing. We talked to our coworkers, who were understandably upset, about how the profits of our labor were being put to ends that none of us supported. We kept building, kept organizing, and a year later won a unanimous wall-to-wall election. Now those workers have a tool with which to keep building power in the workplace for themselves, their friends, and their families, and a foothold for organized labor in an industry riven by borders that would cease to function altogether without the labor of immigrants. No union is automatically or necessarily anti-fascist or abolitionist, but organization is the prerequisite to put these politics into practice, to both defend our comrades, our loved ones, and ourselves, and to build a world where all can live and move freely under conditions of their own choosing. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.